I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, David Remnick talks with New Yorker staff writers Zhiyang Fan and Evan Osnos. They'll discuss the ongoing protests in Hong Kong and the response from the Chinese government.
Donald Trump has made China one of the defining issues of his presidency. He seems to have done everything he can to provoke China. He's ignited a trade war. He's escalated tensions over North Korea and much more. And yet, instead of backing the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong, Trump has reportedly told President Xi Jinping that the United States would remain silent about democracy as they worked out their trade deal. The protests in Hong Kong against Beijing's rule have been going on now for months. Combined with slowing economic growth across the country, they've created a political crisis for Xi Jinping, right at a time when the Communist Party is supposed to be celebrating its 70th year in power. The situation is more serious than anything since the Tiananmen Square uprising a generation ago. Two of our staff writers are recently back from China, Evan Osnos and Zhiyang Fan. Zhiyang, you just got back from Hong Kong, and I want to get a sense first the emotional tenor of what's going on in the streets. What kinds of people are participating, and what's the feeling out there?
I would say 80% of the participants are middle class, working class. They range in age from probably 20 to 75. The folks I spoke to feel just so strongly that they are there to support the freedom that they have understood to be part and parcel of Hong Kong society. I think many of them are undecided about how far they're willing to go, and most of them would claim they're not what's known as frontline protesters.
What is a frontline protester mean?
Right. A frontline protester is the ones that have been featured so prominently in Western media, the ones wearing the gas masks, clad in all black. They occasionally throw the Molotov cocktails and resort to more extreme measures. I think it's really important to point out that that's a pretty minor fraction of the overall community of protesters.
Now, my understanding is that this began with fairly limited demands. It had to do with extradition, for example. And with time, that has broadened. And do these protesters have the sense that they can keep apart from Beijing indefinitely?
When I pose that question to protesters, many of them don't have a very clearly defined answer, and I would dare to say that many of them probably don't even know themselves. What they do feel is the anger that comes from the failure of the umbrella movement, which happened in 2014 over this fight for universal suffrage that did not succeed. And this accumulated sense of anger and grievances that have not properly been met in any way. It's important to say that Hong Kong was never a democracy, even under Britain, but they felt that this was the direction in which they were moving. So there was just this rising panic that Hong Kong was becoming like another mainland city, utterly under the thumb of the Communist Party.
So real fear of being sucked in.
Exactly.
So while Zhang was in Hong Kong, Evan, on the front lines and dodging Molotov cocktails and the rest, you were in Beijing for the 70th anniversary of the revolution. How were the Chinese officials that you were talking to talking about Hong Kong, and how was the Hong Kong drama playing out on the Chinese media?
Well, the contrast really couldn't be more stark. In Beijing, the subject of Hong Kong and its protests has nothing to do with idealism or with young people who are trying to create economic opportunities for themselves or to hold off Beijing's control. It is described in Beijing consistently as a, quote, separatist movement. They think of it as an attempt to try to divide Chinese territory, which, after all, is this very visceral, very specific accusation, because any Chinese person will tell you that the country over the course of history has been invaded and has been carved up. And so by talking about it as an assault on Chinese territory, that's tapping into a very deep political well. And they were doing that to a great extent recently because, after all, they're celebrating 70 years of the People's Republic of China. And one of the ways that they're doing that is by saying we have been able to pull together the country in ways that previous governments never had. And that means resisting things like these protests in Hong Kong.
And how has Xi Jinping handled the protests? Do you expect that the crackdown will become more violent, more stringent than it's already been?
Well, I would not expect that they're going to give in to the protesters' demands. Frankly, there was just no indication in Beijing, and anybody that I've been talking to involved in the sort of strategy about this subject thinks that China is ready to make a deal with Hong Kong. But, you know, the obvious fear, the thing that people have been worried about, is some sort of repeat of the events of 1989 when China cracked down on demonstrators in Tiananmen Square and you had a massacre in which students and other people in the city were killed. But at the same time, there are very real pressures, I think, that are on Xi Jinping not to handle it the same way they handled it in 1989. If they went into Hong Kong today with tanks, for instance, as they did in Beijing, you know, this would devastate a financial capital that is very important to China's economy. It's a, you know, it's got a stock market larger than London's. It's a big source of foreign currency. And more importantly, it would devastate China's effort to try to establish itself on the global stage as a as an alternative to American leadership. And so I think the more likely scenario is that China will keep up the pressure and gradually use its sheer weight and persistence to try to grind down the resistance of protesters in Hong Kong.
Zheng, do you think that people in Hong Kong expect a Tiananmen Square type scenario to take place, or do they feel that that kind of pressure is not on them, that they can go much farther?
Some of the folks I've talked to certainly think that that is a possibility. There is this sense of Shenzhen right across the border, and there being People's Liberation Army barracks there, and also an increase of troops even stationed in Hong Kong. I think there is also among the young this sense of nihilism, this feeling that if the tanks really do roll in, let the world see how brutal the communist regime is. And this is, I would say, again, among the 20 to even, you know, 10% of the of the frontline protesters who, for better or worse, command a lot of attention because they're the ones who are, you know, some of them are talking to Western media and they're the ones throwing the Molotov cocktails.
One of the things that's most striking watching these protests is the sense of the extensive surveillance network that the Chinese government has put into play. How are the protesters able to get around that or not?
You'll see in pictures that they are so fully armored in, you know, scarves, masks, covering every part of their body. I mean, and you have to imagine these are 90-degree days in Hong Kong, and they're covered head to toe, even their ears. And I've been told it's because there is worry or suspicion that the AI is so advanced that even the shape of one's ears can be monitored.
And that's true, or that's paranoia, or true?
I think AI is quite sophisticated. I'm not sure to the extent that the ear shapes can be monitored, but that sense of fear is warranted, I believe.
There was a very telling moment when the Hong Kong protesters started to attack the smart lampposts, as they're called. These are the obviously the sort of nodes of surveillance that have cameras and listening equipment and so on. And they're in their own way, these are the perfect expressions, the physical expressions of China's future governance model. It believes that in the future it can optimize the powers of a one-party state by doing what an old analog state never could. It could never listen in on every conversation. It could never track people as they moved around a city. Well, technology allows that now. And that's one of the ways that this government imagines that it's going to try to extend its longevity. I mean, it is, after all, at a very acute moment in its own history. It's been in power 70 years. It's surpassed the longevity of the Soviet Union, but it is acutely aware that one-party states do not have a long lifespan. And so Xi Jinping's personal determination is to try to, you know, in some sense, prevent the inertia of history from coming down on top of him.
Zheng, Xi Jinping has, for all intents and purposes, made himself president for life. I don't see it any other way. What conditions allowed him to consolidate power so swiftly and effectively?
I think early on, his corruption campaign, which really won the hearts and minds of the citizenry across China was a very astute way to fight political enemies. I think when he came to power, he realized that there were still lingering factions. And one has to understand that even within the Communist Party, there's a lot of infighting. And the greatest threat to a political leader is not actually the people protesting or even, you know, the economy, but other rivaling factions trying to topple him. I think he also very deftly nursed this cult of personality. He thinks that he really is, you know, a national deity. He has convinced the people that only he can lead the country into superpower status, the transition really from the century of shame that China has experienced, at least in the Chinese narrative, at the hands of foreign powers, to a nation that will ultimately outdo the United States.
Well, journalists are known, of course, as great mind readers, so I'll let you exercise that capacity here. How does Xi Jinping see a figure like Donald Trump?
Take the two of them, put them side by side for a minute. Xi Jinping began his career in the very center of party power, grew up in Beijing. His father was a senior party leader. Xi Jinping spent his entire career essentially moving up the ladder of obscure party posts until eventually, you know, at one point he was the head of the Feed Association in a rural province. He makes his way up, becomes governor of provinces, and then finally gets his chance by keeping his mouth closed. He never let on to his peers what he believed, never created a lot of enemies in the system, and using that method, he made his way to the top. Now look at Donald Trump. They are in every conceivable stylistic and personal way different. And I think Xi Jinping looks across the table at Donald Trump and finds him utterly mystifying. One of the things that's happened over the last 2 years is that everything that Chinese diplomats and politicians had come to believe about how American politics works has been chucked out the window. And so Xi Jinping has no trust in what Donald Trump tells him. He doesn't trust him on the trade war. He doesn't trust him on these assurances of one thing or another. And so he's coming from a position of total and complete self-protection first and do not rely on the United States for anything.
It was so interesting to me. I was watching on television some of these protests, and you see occasionally an American flag being waved or a British flag being waved. And at the same time, President Trump has been absolutely silent about these protests. He's not said one word of encouragement or praise or pro-democratic sentiment. Jiang, how is that being received on the streets of Hong Kong?
I asked one of the protesters who was wielding the American flag, I asked what her intention was, and she said, in this war, there is no one who's powerful enough to save Hong Kong except possibly the U.S. And we need to make sure the U.S. knows how exactly critical the situation is here. And then I followed up with a question about Trump and what she thought of Trump's response. And she said, I can't get bogged down the details right now. All I need is for some of the politicians in Washington to see.
But surely they're aware that this is a president who does not press human rights issues on the Chinese leadership, has not mentioned democratic values to the Chinese leadership. If anything, his greatest emphasis lately, is besides trade, which is a big issue, is to get the Chinese, as with other countries, to investigate the Biden family.
Which is why I think some of the pro-Beijing folks that I spoke to is really encouraged, frankly, that Trump won the election instead of Hillary, and the sense that this is not a concern for Washington, and that at the end of the day, Trump is only interested in making a deal, and human rights was never high on his agenda. So when push comes to shove, especially with the trade war, the fact that Trump might be looking for leverage or for kind of pawns, that Hong Kong just might be one of, you know, the cards that he has to play. I think many of the pro-Beijing folks that I talk to are fairly happy that Trump is in command right now.
Just recently, Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, said, China will never interfere in the internal affairs of the United States, and we trust that the American people are capable of sorting out their own problems. In this context, I'd ask you both, does that mean that they're likely to take a pass on investigating the Bidens or interfering in the 2020 elections?
I think, yeah, they do not particularly want to get involved here. I think this is one in which I will take them at face value. And I'll give you one data point.
Why does that make them different from the Russians? The Russians seem to love to thrive on the idea of chaos in American public life as a result of, or at least partly as a result of, their interference in the election and, by extension, Trump's victory. Why would the Chinese not feel the same way? Chinese thrive on something else?
Well, China loves the fact that the United States is engaged in these kinds of, obviously paralyzing internal fights. That's just been very helpful to China on the world stage. But at the same time, China is prudent about not wanting to provoke any more response than it needs to. And I'll give you a useful bit of history on this, which is that China actually, we know this, this is not a hidden fact, China hacked into the 2008 campaign, according to U.S. intelligence agencies, but it never weaponized the information. It never used it. It never pushed it back out into the public sphere the way that Russia did. What it did is it really used it for intelligence gathering purposes. It hoovered up this stuff and held on to it for its own sense of trying to predict what was going to happen. China would be much happier to watch the United States go through its own paroxysms of political disorder than to risk the possibility of engendering some American backlash by actively intervening.
Jiang and Evan, if you had to guess, who are the Chinese rooting for to win the presidential election and why?
I think that Elizabeth Warren is someone that China would not want to win the election. The sense that she is someone who seems to have convictions about human rights and someone who will not let China get away with what it does within its borders, I think is worrying. I think someone like Bernie Sanders is someone who can be more attractive because Bernie at least doesn't seem to have much interest in getting involved.
Evan?
In general, the Communist Party prefers Republican presidents in the United States because they're, in a sense, more likely to be business-oriented. They're going to be pro-trade and so on. But this Republican president has scrambled the circuits to such a degree in Beijing that they really don't know. And they're, in some sense, they're edging towards the known quantities. They've worked with Joe Biden as a vice president. They feel a little bit more familiar with him. He's frankly one of the only names that they really know out of this field. So they're watching it very carefully, but they are at this point totally undone by Donald Trump, and they don't really believe that he would be a reliable counterparty.
Evan Osnos and Jiang Fan, I know you're still suffering from jet lag coming back from China. My thanks to you.
Thanks, David.
Thanks so much.
Jiang Fan and Evan Osnos. Both are staff writers, and you can read all their coverage of China at newyorker.com.